The first passenger had improved the shining hours since they left Navern by going to sleep. He lay curled on his side in the sleep sack. Harris listened a while and decided the snore was genuine, not faked.
Let him complete his slumbers. We'll have a word with the other one.
The other one glowered at them from the sleep sack he had folded into a seating pad.
This is unconscionable. Not even a bed.
I know. It's so sad that both of you must suffer. But your father expects you will understand.
My father? Easy enough for him to send me off without even my servants.
If either you or your double had been cooperative, we might have been able to improve matters. Now that we're underway, suppose you tell us which you are.
Which?
Harris wished she dared smack him.
Whether you are the prince or the fellow down the corridor.
Oh. I don't think either one of us is the prince.
You don't think?
No. I'm not really sure. I mean, I know I'm not the prince, but we switch around so much, you know, that I rather lose track.
All clones? All his clones?
I suppose so. I never really thought.
And do you have a name? When you aren't using the prince's, I mean?
Mr. Smith. Gerald Smith. It's all I've ever been called. We all use it. His name is Gerald, so ours had to be close enough that his would be familiar and yet not the same. My middle initial's B, so I'm the second one.
Harris wanted to ask him if they were all as stupid as the prince himself, but thought better of it. More important at the moment was the size of her problem.
How many of you clones are there?
Three, at least. I went through the first stages of training with two others. Our fourth had a metabolic problem and died early. But we might not have been the only cluster. On the other hand, we're almost never all together. So if one of us died in the line of duty, the others wouldn't know.
Why so many? I thought clones were expensive, and the confusion must have been difficult.
We are also prone to losses in the early embryonic stages, just as non-clones are. Given the expense, they don't take chances. They bring a cluster along together. If it's absolutely necessary to have a clone in place, as it is here, it's much safer to have a spare or two.
Or three. By any chance, was another clone on Navern? Or the prince himself?
No. I was primary this trip, and Gerald C. was secondary. At least I think that's Gerald C. you've got in the other room. I don't know where Gerald A. or Gerald Prime is.
Gerald Prime being your code name for the prince?
The clone nodded. Harris could not see any difference between him and the prince she had transported from Cerealis. If that had been the prince, she had a sudden chilling suspicion that maybe her passenger had been one of the other clones, and the prince himself not involved in any of that mess. Yet the king clearly thought that had been the real one.
How are you briefed about the prince's activities? Surely all of you must be kept up to date on his recent actions, and he on yours. Who monitors your, personal interactions and your personality profile?
Harris had trouble thinking of this as Gerald B., but she made herself repeat it silently. This was Gerald B., an individual, though genetically identical.
We all carry implanted recorders. They're harvested regularly by a Crown-certified technician, and we're retaped with others at the same time. Usually takes a couple of hours. I've been told the prince is also equipped for retaping.
Like training tapes?
I've been told it's like the military training tapes, the ones used before simulator training.
Ah.
With the right drug induction, those were powerful. One could almost believe one had already been through the simulators.
As for the personality profile, we are evaluated on that at every retaping, as we are for physical parameters.
Harris noted that Gerald B. seemed a lot more cooperative now than he had been, and wondered why. Did he have some conditioned response to a phrase she'd used? Or was the admission of his clone identity a releaser for more cooperation?
That's why I'm not sure about the others. We're not encouraged to concern ourselves with the actual identity of the person presenting himself as the prince, nor are we encouraged to form independent relationships with each other. We're just doubles. Our value lies in being mistaken for the prince, not each other.
What a sad life.
Don't pity me. I've seen so many singletons trying to be mistaken for a parent, a mentor, a patron. They, who could be themselves wholly and freely, choose to copy another almost as closely as I must. So it can't be that bad. Besides, my prime is a wealthy, privileged young man. I enjoy those advantages even when I'm not on.
True, But such a philosophical outlook was nothing like the prince as Harris had known him. Were they as bright as the prince should have been? And if so, how did they feign stupidity? Did they know it was stupidity they were feigning?
Have you been retaped on what happened at Cerealis?
Oh, yes. A courier brought both physician and tapes. It was an emergency, such a dramatic break. Actually, there was some concern that Gerald A., who had been first doubling right then, should have broken his role to inform the authorities when the prince left. But it was decided once more that our role should be confined to doubling, not surveillance.
Curiouser and curiouser. Gerald B. began to sound more and more intelligent and mature. That alone made it likely he wasn't the prince. He could feign stupidity more easily than a stupid person could feign intelligence. But, again, she wondered if the real prince had been the one drugged.
So, you would not know from seeing someone on a ship-to-ship video if it were the prince or another clone?
Nor just from seeing him, only if he broke role and revealed himself.
Livati arrived at the rendezvous an hour after Harris, weapons dark to her scan. A good sign, if he hadn't managed to fox her scans. Nor did his weapons light, though he must have known hers were hot. Slowly, they brought the ships close.
You don't entirely trust me.
No. Should I? You know these people. Members of my crew, court-martialed with false evidence, imprisoned. Too many of them died. Where were you, Livati? When I needed friends in the fleet, when I needed someone to testify at my own hearing.
I was convinced you had done what they said. Sorry, Harris, but that's the truth. Your own cousin, Marion, your uncle, Sabato. I thought if they spoke against you with such sorrow and regret, it must be true.
Harris wasn't as angry as she'd expected to be. His lack of support hurt, but it had melted into the general pain she felt that none of her friends at Fleet had come to her aid.
Yet you had known me. You wonder why I don't trust you now? That's the smallest part of it. You've heard about Lupescu?
Only that he died, and rumor said discreditably.
Harris could almost see the question struggling for precedence in his head.
He was involved in a group that hunted humans for sport.
His eyes widened. Even with what he knew of Lupescu, that shocked him.
He was killed and the surviving victims freed. More than that, I should not say.
You were there?
I was there. I witnessed it. He's definitely dead. And so are his associates on that trip, while records have been found listing those who accompanied him other times.
Livati stirred. Harris searched his face, finding nothing certain.
If you have such experience, it's one more reason I should not trust you. Although, I myself suspect he sometimes lured officers into it and then blackmailed them later.
Livati flushed. Harris simply looked at him until his color returned to normal. So, now she knew. But what would he do?
Suppose the Crown knows all about it.
I would imagine so.
Nobody said anything. I mean, I haven't heard any rumors.
I suppose the investigations aren't complete, and they're not moving until they are. Besides, why ruin the careers of good officers for one mistake?
Her one mistake had saved lives and won a battle, but still cost her a career. Livati looked at her oddly.
I hope that attitude prevails. Though I'm surprised to find you so lenient.
You mistake me. I'm not lenient at all. This is not my fight. Carrying out the king's request is. I will not let any old grievances get in my way.
I see. And you have no interest in rekindling an old friendship? You would prefer that former shipmate?
My former shipmate suffered considerably on my behalf. They proved themselves trustworthy. Can you blame me for wanting to put trust where it's been rewarded before?
No, I suppose not. Well, then, what about the mission?
You tell me what your mission was, and I will decide if you're a potential help or hindrance to mine.
You've acquired an even keener edge to your blade. You know the regulations.
And the realities. Come now. If you are loyal to the Crown and the Familias, you know why I have to hear your mission, and before I tell you of mine.
All right. I was told that you were going to Navarin Station to take the Prince to the Guerni Republic, but that by a mix-up, the Prince's double was there instead. I was supposed to transport the Prince and intercept you, ensuring that you had the right person aboard. I was to do this not while you were on station, but in deep space, to avoid detection. We expected you to be there another day or so, and I was going to hang about in system. As you know, RSS ships do sometimes observe in that system. My, sources told me that one of your crew had obtained, if that's the right word, a tight beam receiver. So I planned to contact you before you left Navarne Station, so that we could rendezvous at a distance, making it look like a routine inspection.
Except that there are no routine inspections out here, as you well know.
It was all I could think of.
Harris would like to have made a sharp comeback, but she couldn't think of a better plan herself, not off the top of her head.
What were you supposed to do with the double I had?
Take him to Xavier, where he's booked on a commercial liner, and put him aboard.
I see. You're right. We were supposed to impersonate a small independent cargo vessel and transport the prince to the Guerny Republic. I was told his double would take over on Navarne.
But you snatched his double.
But only because he was refusing to come and I could not distinguish them, since they were clones.
That should have told you they were fakes, neither of them the prince.
Not necessarily. After all, they matched the prince's ID specs.
They can't. They're clones of each other, not of the prince.
Harris spread out the hard copy of the identification specs in front of the scanner.
Let's check that out. Is this what you got?
Yes. Close, at least. I'll need to check mine.
He touched one of his screens and pointed a wand at the input screen from Harris. After a moment, he blanked his screen.
The same, our computer says. And our man matches. That means...
Three clones. One of them the prince.
Maybe, and maybe not.
There's only one thing to do. Get all three of them where we were supposed to take the prince and let the medical personnel sort it out.
But that will risk detection.
So would taking in a Vacrone clone as the prince. Do you think they couldn't tell? The clones tell me that there is a technique, not part of the identification scan, but something to do with leftover markers of accelerated growth.
But I can't take my ship off to the Guerny Republic. I have another assignment.
Then send your putative prince over here and I'll take all three of them.
But... alone?
You said it yourself. If you show up there in a Familius RSS cruiser, it'll be an incident with a capital I. It's safe enough for me. I've never been there, and neither has this ship.
I don't like it, but I can't think what else to do. I suppose you have a shuttle lock on that thing?
Harris nodded to Petrus and Kulkul, who picked up their weapons and left the bridge.
Yes. You can send your pinnace over and swim him through the tube.
By the way, I am authorized to tell you that a certain Lady Cecilia disappeared from an extended care medical facility a few weeks after you left Rockhouse Major. Would you like to explain that to me?
No, I would not.
But that wouldn't do. Livati would pursue the mystery eagerly, just to annoy her.
She was my former employer. You may have heard. She had a stroke, and her family blamed me. That's why the king thought my leaving with the yacht wouldn't be connected to any plan of his.
But why was I told to tell you?
I can't imagine. I can't say I think much of her family, keeping her in a place with no better surveillance than that. I hope she's in good hands. Who's your new admiral?
Silipu. Remember her?
His comments on the changes in command since Lupescu's death filled all the time it took to unload the prince and retrieve the pinnace. When he signed off, she wondered just how much she'd fooled him.
We're almost there.
Cecilia had come to prefer Brun's hands to others. She had no professional skill, but a very human affection to convey. Amazing how different she was from the girl who had thrown up in the lounge of Cecilia's yacht. It was hard to believe she had ever seemed a selfish fluffhead. Was it the adventure she'd had on the island, or just normal maturation? She had helped dress Cecilia, this time in clothes Cecilia could feel. Soft pants and shirt, a soft tunic, low soft boots. She had helped lift Cecilia into the hover chair. The inflated supports held Cecilia's head steady and gave her, she hoped, the look of someone disabled but alert. For now, the hover chair was locked down. Cecilia felt a moment's panic, but Brun's hand stroking her hair calmed her. She hated herself for that panic. She could not get used to being helpless, blind, vulnerable. She wanted to be brave and calm.
It's all right. You are brave. It's just no one could be every single minute.
If this was what children could be like, she should have had children. Ronnie, whom she'd despised, and this girl, whom she had once dismissed as a fluffhead, had rescued her when adults her own age either didn't care or couldn't think what to do. She would have to revise her ideas about young people. Of course, when she herself was young, she'd known young people had sense. But looking back at her own idiocies later, she'd forgotten the generosity, the courage. Her stomach rolled. Without sight, she felt nausea and swallowed it nervously. The chair, unlocked, floated at Brunn's push through air that stank of fuels and hot metals and plastics, then into a smell of leather and dust. A vehicle filling with people and luggage, then a jerk and a swerve, and more movement she could not see. A cool current of air blew the hair off her face. Soon it smelled of mourning in the country, though a different country than she'd left. A pungent herb tickled her nose, teasing her with a vagrant memory. She should know that smell, and these others that crowded in. Pines, dew-wet grass under the sun, plowed fields, horses, cattle, goats. Cecilia breathed it in. Only a few weeks ago, she'd been trapped in the sterile room without even the scent of flowers. Now, she could eat and move a few muscles on her own and live in a place that smelled good. Finally, it all came together. The sharp smell of the purple-flowered herb, the broader, roasting scent of tall yellow flowers edging the road, the squatty, resinous pines of the dry hills and the lush grass of valleys. She knew which planet, of all the planets she'd visited, and she began to suspect the exact place. She knew when the vehicle turned where she had come. Her body had felt that sequence of swerves and bounces too often to forget it. Into her mind sprang the picture she had had so long on the screen of her study. The stable yard with its rows of stalls. The cats sprawled in the sun after a night chasing mice. The long house with its high-ceilinged rooms that were cool even in midsummer. She felt the hot tears running down her face.
Do you know where you are now?
Cecilia's shoulder came up, emphatic yes.
I'm home. I'm where I should never have left. Home on Rotterdam, at the stable I left to Meredith.
The vehicle they were in, the old farm van, rolled to a bumpy stop. She knew within 10 centimeters where they were, just far enough past the mud puddle that someone stepping out wouldn't land in it. Pulled to one side to let the hay trucks get to the gate.
Near feeding time.
She smelled hay and oats and molasses and horses and leather. But it was going to be worse in a way. To be here among horses and the people who cared for them and be unable to move, to see, to talk, to ride. Pain and longing contended in her mind. She recognized that horse was not the same as either of the others. At least she had not lost her ear for horse voices. At least it was going to be better than that sterile nursing home. And they thought she had a chance of recovery, at least partial recovery. She felt the coolness when the hover chair reached the shadow of the entrance, up 3 steps and across the porch. The house smelled different. Someone here had cooked foods she didn't particularly like, and the downstairs hall didn't have the pleasant aroma of leather, but a more formal scent, something floral but artificial. But she recognized the machine oil smell. She had had the lift installed after struggling up the spiral stairs 1 too many times on crutches. That broken ankle, the 3rd one. She wouldn't buy a hover chair then. Only old people used them. Brunn pushed her hover chair into the lift and slid the doors closed. The lift jerked and they were on their way upstairs. Cecilia wished she could see the upstairs passage with the arched windows on either end and the shining wood floor. Or was it still shining?
You'll be in your own room. It's not the same, of course. The furnishings, do you want me to describe them?
Cecilia thought about that. She had such vivid memories of this room, every detail of fabric, every ornament on the shelf above the window. She wanted to sink back into that. And yet, the room sounded different and smelled different. She'd have that discord between the visual memory and the auditory reality if she clung to the past. Her shoulder jerked yes, and Brunn squeezed it a moment.
I'll bet you remember everything, and you wish you could keep it that way. But here's what it looks like to me. The walls are dark cream.
They'd aged. They needed a new coat of paint every few years to keep the precise tone Cecilia had chosen.
There's a medbed in place of yours. You'll be on monitoring a while longer. But the cover is one of those Reckian hand-woven blankets in green and gold and tan, with flecks of orange in the gold. The pattern's more an irregular stripe than anything else. The bed has its head against the far wall. The window over the yard will be on your left as you lie in bed. Is that right?
Cecilia signaled yes again.
Good. We didn't put anything on the windows. There's a wooden chest painted Ork's blood red against the wall opposite the bed, and a tall bookcase chest on the wall to the right next to that window. A couple of reproduction Darien side chairs we picked up in the city, and no rug in here at all.
Cecilia wanted to ask about the pictures on the wall. She had taken her Piucci originals, the portraits of her top horses, but had left behind the old hunting scenes. But Brunn said nothing about that.
Here are your clothes. Your new clothes, I should say. Your friends thought of trying to get your own, clothes you knew by feel and smell, but decided it was too risky. Brunn gave us a shopping list, and you're now equipped with the basics, in colors she remembers you wearing, including riding attire.
Riding attire? She couldn't ride. Might never ride again. For all she knew, she was bloated up to the size of Brunn's hot air balloon, and no horse could hold her up. She jerked her shoulder no.
Yes, you've got breeches and boots and a helmet for the very good reason that you are going to ride again. You are.
The fierceness of the young, who thought wanting something enough made it happen. Cecilia had heard that tone in her own voice when she insisted she would ride again after this or that accident. Then she had believed it. Now, she wasn't sure.
You're facing a time limit. One formal, the legal requirement to show competency before your estate is finally distributed, and one informal, before whoever did this to you finds you. So we aren't going to waste any time. You'll have a full schedule of rehab work every day, no vacations.
Cecilia thought about that, and her immediate wish to stretch out on that unseen medbed, and jerked her shoulder yes with as much emphasis as the earlier no. She was tired, but better to be tired than forever lost in this helplessness.
Except tonight. Most of your therapists are still in transit. We didn't want to make it obvious where you were if someone's keeping track of them, so they've had to take roundabout routes. So tonight, you can just rest.
Until that moment, she hadn't thought of pursuit. Brunn had mentioned it, but reality itself seemed hardly real. Now, with the familiar smells and sounds around her, the thought of being recaptured, returned to a blank prison existence, terrified her.
It's the wrong place, the obvious place. Anyone would know where I am. What fools!
It's all right. It's not as obvious as you think. Rotterdam has horses, but no advanced medical facilities. It's far from the logical place for someone in your condition. Your lifelong investments in Rotterdam, money, but also time and friendship, mean that few mouths will talk. And even if they do, Rotterdam lies far off the usual networks of transport and communication. They'll figure out it was Dad's yacht eventually. They'll think of Cerealis, and then Korholm, where most of the pharmaceutical research is done. They may send a query about Rotterdam, but I'm assured nothing will come of it, at least not for months.
Cecilia hoped Brunn was right. She would much rather die than go back to that non-life. Her earlier experiences in recovering from more minor injuries helped only a little. It had been 20 years since her last broken bone. Well, large broken bone. And longer than that since the near-fatal headlong crash in the trials. She had forgotten how infuriating it was to struggle, panting for what seemed like hours, in order to twitch something slightly, again and again until she was a quivering wreck. She had forgotten how much weakened muscles and ligaments hurt when forced to work again. She had forgotten how even the best therapists talked over their patients' heads as if they weren't really there. And she was tired, bone-tired, sore, short of sleep, because she woke in a panic night after night, afraid she was back in the nursing home. With so limited a communication system, she couldn't tell them that, and they'd decided she would sleep better alone. She was too old for this. She didn't have the resilience, the sheer energy, that she had had 2 decades before. She had not believed she was old, not the woman who could still ride to hounds. But now she believed it. If she had been able to talk, she would have said it. She would have argued out of exhaustion and despair that they were wasting their time. She couldn't talk. She could only endure. But twice a day, between sessions with physical therapists and occupational therapists and massage therapists and tests and all the rest, Brunn took her out to the stable yard. That was her reward for a good morning, incentive for a good afternoon. She learned each horse's voice and the voices of the stable hands only a few days later. Brunn poured handfuls of sweet feed into her passive hand, and she felt the soft velvet horse lips mumbling over her palm. Brunn lifted her hands and laid them against satiny necks and shoulders. The first time her fingers really moved, it was along a horse's shoulder. Her first strong grasp was of a horse's mane. And yet she hated the obviousness of it. She did not want her love of horses to be so utilitarian, so selfish. They deserved her love for themselves, not because it could help her therapy. She would have sulked, except how could she sulk when she couldn't talk at all? How could she rage when her movements were slow and awkward and she couldn't scream?
Cecilia Free.
Harris held that thought in mind as she laid out the roundabout safe course from their present location to the Guerny Republic. It had to be Brunn's plan. She told herself that the villains in this piece had no reason to abscond with Cecilia. Only her friends did. Only Brunn could have put together the resources to do it. She imagined Cecilia in Cerealis. It was easy to imagine her in rooms Harris had seen, around horses and people she knew. Obvious, of course, to the king and anyone else, but she put it out of her mind. Brunn had acted. The first part had gone well. She could do nothing herself until she'd delivered these clones and the prince, if he was one of them.
Then I'll find Cecilia.
Somewhat to Harris's surprise, the rest of the trip to the Guerny Republic went peacefully, jump point after jump point, day after day after day. The three clones, each of whom insisted he was not the prince, were less trouble than Ronnie and George had been at first. They agreed to wear name tags to help the crew avoid the confusion of offering a meal to a clone who had already eaten. This helped, although it occurred to Harris that they might switch the name tags for a lark. Harris could not assess their intelligence, not with the possibility, no likelihood, that they would not cooperate and perform at their best. Yet they seemed to have more common sense than she'd expected.
There's no use our pretending with all three of us here. Our cover's blown totally as far as you and the others aboard this ship are concerned. You know we're clones of the prince, and you know what that means legally. It wouldn't matter if one of us were the prince. The damage has already been done.
You mean we're now a danger to the prince? Or to the crown?
No, we are. After all, that cruiser captain knows. Some of his crew either know or suspect. There's no way to be sure the secret's safe, even if they silenced you. They'll probably dump us.
Petrus put down his fork.
Kill you?
No, there are other ways. They can do a plastic surgery to make us no longer doubles, and there's some kind of way to mark our genomes more prominently. Look through the microscope and the chromosomes spell clone.
Harris wondered if their calmness was part of their act.
But what will you do? Have you had any...
Job training? No, we just laze around acting like silly-ass rich boys. Some. We've had lots of courses and all sorts of things he's supposed to know. Of course, we don't attend formal classes or get degrees, but I'm sure they'll cobble up some sort of resume for us.
They seemed remarkably unconcerned, but they were, Harris reminded herself, 20 or more years younger than she. People that age had more confidence than their lack of experience warranted. Except for Sirkin. Something was wrong, and Harris couldn't quite figure it out. Of course, she would still be grieving for Amelie. That might be it. She had seen violent death up close for the first time in her life, and the victim was someone she loved. But Harris had seen other young people deal with their first serious losses. Usually they came back to normal in fits and spurts, but with an upward trend. Sirkin had seemed to be recovering normally, but then took a downward turn. Harris didn't expect her to be lively, happy, or full of the sparkle that had first convinced her the girl was a good prospect, but she did expect consistent good work at her job, and that's where Sirkin had begun to fail. Only little things so far, a missing log entry after a course change, a data cube left out on the counter rather than filed in its case. Harris had been tactful at first, murmuring reminders when she found the data cube, noticed the missing entry. Sirkin had looked appropriately remorseful and made quick corrections. But it went on. The other crew had noticed.
I don't care what your problem is, Bright Eyes, but if you don't shape up, the captain will kick your tail off this ship the next port we come to. It's not like you can't do better. We know you can. And don't tell me it's grieving over Irulan, because we could tell you were really falling for Brune.
Harris paused, just out of sight. Perhaps Oblo could do better at unkinking Sirkin than she had so far.
But I did tell you. I did log the jump coordinates. I entered them shift before last.
They're not here. And Issy was on just after you. Are you telling me he wiped your log entry?
No, I don't know. I know I made that entry. I went over it twice because I know I've been making mistakes somehow. It was there, I swear.
Don't bother. You don't know how. See here, girl. You have only two possibilities. Either you didn't enter anything, or someone wiped it. Now, I know damn well Issy wouldn't wipe it. Nor would I, nor would the captain. Who are you accusing? You think one of those clones sneaked in here?
I don't know. I don't know what's happening. I was so careful, and then it's gone.
I've got to tell the captain. You know that. I can't pretend not to notice something like that. It could kill us all later.
I know that. I can't explain it.
Harris shook her head and went on in. Sirkin looked tired and unkempt. That was new. She had always been neatly groomed and bright-eyed. What could be wrong with the girl?
Miss Sirkin, I'll see you in my office, please.
She did not miss the desperate look Sirkin threw at Oblo, who gave her no encouragement at all. Sirkin's explanation, if one could call it that, made little sense. She was trying to be careful. She didn't understand how these mistakes happened. She was sure she'd logged the course changes and jump points and had no idea how they had vanished from the log. Her hands trembled and her eyes were bloodshot.
Are you taking anything?
Drugs seemed likely, given the combination of physical appearance and absent-mindedness. Sirkin hadn't used before, that she knew of, but in the stress of Irulan's death, perhaps the girl had started.
No, ma'am. Not even the pills the doctor gave me after... after Amelie. Things are just coming undone. And that makes me sound like Amelie. I mean, she used to say things like that. I wonder if she felt like this. Trying and trying, and nothing seems to work.
Sirkin, we both know you're capable of better. You were doing extremely well up until we left Rockhouse Major. You must have some idea what's gone wrong. Is someone bothering you?
Harris was sure she could trust her former crew not to harass a young civilian, but it was only fair to ask. Skoderin, the newest? She'd have expected one of the others to notice and straighten out the offender, or at least tell her. No, more likely one of the clones, assuming a royal right to any pretty face and body. She wouldn't put it past them to bring drugs aboard, either.
No, ma'am. Nobody's bothered me. I know I still miss Amelie, but I honestly don't think it's that. It's just I do something, or think I do something, and then later it's not done. I don't understand it. Maybe I'm going crazy.
She looked up with an expression Harris had seen too many times on youngsters who had somehow gotten out of their depth and hoped an elder had a magic solution. Going crazy had been a favorite hypothesis in one ship, because there were medicines for going crazy. Simple inattention and laziness had no cure.
I don't think you're going crazy, but I do think you can pull yourself together, and you must. Tell you what, let's let another bridge officer sign off on your log entries for a few days. If those entries disappear, we'll know it's not your fault, and you'll have a witness to having made them. How's that?
It was an insult, but Sirkin took the suggestion as gratefully as if it had been praise.
Now, take the rest of this shift off. We've no jump points coming up, and put yourself to bed. You look exhausted.
Yes, ma'am.
As Harris expected, Sirkin's log entries didn't disappear when someone else countersigned them. So, logically, Sirkin had never made the earlier entries. It wasn't a computer glitch. It was the far more common human error. Sirkin seemed to be making fewer of them now, in all categories. Another data point on the plot of carelessness. Her appearance improved. She looked almost normal, if not the bright-eyed girl she had been. Oblo and Issy reported that she seemed alert, careful, everything she should be. Just to be sure, Harris asked about conflicts with the crew. As she'd expected, they all insisted they liked the girl. None of them reported conflict with anyone else. And a discreet surveillance indicated that she wasn't sneaking off to one of the clones, or any of them to her, when she was off duty. Harris worried, unsatisfied. She sensed something wrong and promised herself to pursue it once the clones had been delivered safely for medical attention. One morning, Cecilia lay in her bed and did her best to hate herself to death. She was too old to rage at simple unfairness, but the unfairness of her situation went beyond anything she could accept. When Brunn came to dress her and take her to breakfast, she did not respond to the usual morning sallies. The smell of hot bread and sage honey roused no response. She wasn't hungry, and she wouldn't eat. After the necessary rituals of personal care, she waited for her first workout, numb and passive.
"We've got someone new, a specialist who might help. We had to wait because she's so well known, just the person they might be watching."
"Hi, I'm Carly, your new therapist."
"Another new therapist. I need that like I need a fluorescent bathing suit."
"You're very angry. Did you know you could show that without words?"
Cecilia did not bother to twitch her answer. It was a lucky guess, that was all, or the infuriating certainty that she was in a predicted stage. They couldn't tell. They'd been nagging her because she didn't have control of her facial muscles, so it couldn't be the scowl she would like to have worn. A warm hand lay on her arm. It radiated comfort.
"Here. Anger tenses certain muscle groups, and fear tenses different ones. You're tense in all the anger groups. I don't think the others saw that because of the overall weakness. Does it make you even more angry that I know you're angry?"
Cecilia thought about it, drawn into the intellectual puzzle despite herself. If it was an observation of her real self, she didn't mind. It was being put into a category that made her want to scream. Carly's hand moved slowly along Cecilia's arm.
"You're not as angry now. Perhaps because I paid real attention to you and not a theory?"
Cecilia could feel herself calming, the prickly rage receding.
"You've had good therapists, but they're young. And the enthusiasms of younglings can drive anyone mature to tears or screams. Besides, they've worked you too hard. I think you're tired, more than they've believed. Would you like to sleep?"
Cecilia twitched yes, and then shrugged both shoulders.
"You would, but what's the use? Or you would, but then this session is wasted."
Cecilia wondered how she was supposed to answer that with a yes or no, and in the silence, a peaceful, accepting silence, wondered if she could move anything else enough to communicate. She had clamped onto a horse's mane, first with her right hand, and then with both. If the first alternative was one hand, the second could be both. She tried to visualize her hands moving and felt the fabric under her fingers slide across her fingertips.
"Both hands. That would be the second choice, I expect. Can you confirm with your shoulder?"
"Yes."
"Then I would say this session is not a waste, even if you sleep the rest of it. You're tense and angry and very tired. I'm going to make you comfortable."
Carly's warm hands, steady and firm, needed sore muscles and ligaments. Not the massages that Cecilia remembered, but something deeper and more serious. Soon she was drifting, not quite in contact with her aging body, but not in the sensory limbo of the drugs. She felt warm, contented, relaxed, and very sleepy. When she woke, she felt completely adrift. Someone's hands steadied her back. She was leaning against, over, something.
"It's all right. You slept well, and now you're resting on a large padded ball. If your arms feel funny, it's because they're hanging free, not at your sides.
It felt worse than funny. It felt ridiculous. Yet it also felt good, and she was rested and comfortable.
Can you wiggle your hands again?
Cecilia tried. With her arms resting against the curve of the ball, almost dangling, she could move her fingers. She could feel them shift across the fabric one by one.
Excellent. Some of the things they worried about aren't so. You don't have real spasticity in your fingers. The weakness and the tension in your arms have made it seem so. In this position, when you're rested, you might even tap a keyboard.
A keyboard. A keyboard meant letters, meant words, meant language, meant, she had been told this, a speech synthesizer. Real communication, not just twitches and jerks. She wanted to cry and laugh at once. She felt her shoulders seize, cramping. Carly rubbed the cramps out.
Right now, the biochemical responses of your limbic system are working against you. Like anyone else, you'll do best when you're relaxed and happy. That's my job.
Why didn't the others think of this?
Cecilia felt the difference in Carly's hands as they responded to her muscles rather than trying to overpower them. Her arms twitched, trembled, then finally hung relaxed and heavy. Comfortable. It had been so long since she'd been really comfortable.
It's been known for a very long time, but it's tricky to do, and a lot of people don't think it's important. If a regen tank will work, if the rehab is expected to be short, then they say why bother? I think it's always worth it, for the patient's comfort, if nothing else. And in cases like this, it's essential.
Cecilia felt mildly alert, rested, ready to try again. That afternoon, the relentless work with weights seemed less impossible. The Guerni Republic traded widely with a dozen different political entities. On one side, the compassionate hand and the familius regnant beyond. On the other, Athar's world and its allies, a confederation so loose it refused the name. On yet another, some solo worlds so scattered that political union had so far been impractical. Like Italy's central protrusion into the Mediterranean on Old Earth, back when that body of water was known as Mare Nostrum, the Guerni Republic enjoyed a location both handy for trade and easy to defend. As a result of their location and the resulting trade, the Guernesi had developed efficient and relatively painless entrance protocols. But efficient, painless, and swift did not mean careless. The comm screen showed a bright-faced young woman in blue.
While it's no concern of ours, are you aware that your broadcast ID and your ship do not agree?
I beg your pardon?
According to our database, the Better Luck was scrapped over in Jim Dandy 8 years ago. I know the Familia's records aren't kept that long, but if you bought this ship as the Better Luck, we could provide the data to sustain a claim of fraud.
For a price, of course. The Guernesi, polite and willing to help, did nothing for nothing. Harris had trouble not looking at Oblo. He would be embarrassed.
I don't think that will be necessary.
On the other hand, if you reprogrammed the beacon, your tech did an excellent job. Even got the warble in the 92 band exactly right. We have people who would pay a bonus for that kind of work, if that individual is here and wants to immigrate.
Another thing about the Guernesi, they were always looking for a profit.
Now, I notice you have major ship weapons aboard. Since you've come in past compassionate hand space, I'm afraid we'll have to visually inspect and seal them. I don't want to insult you, but the Benignity tries our borders at intervals.
How did you know? Your scans are... Are they for sale?
The young woman dimpled at him.
Of course, sir. I can give your captain a list of suppliers certified by the government. We have no restrictions on the foreign purchase of military-grade materials.
Mr. Janice will accompany you on your inspection of the weapons. What about small arms?
May not be taken off the ship. The penalty is death and destruction of the ship that brought you. If you want to shoot yourselves aboard your own ship, that's your business.
She typed on a keyboard just out of view.
I'm just asking our weapons inspection team to step aboard. If your Mr. Janice will meet them at the access hatch.
Of course. Harris was already impressed. She had never been here. RSS vessels visited only on ambassadorial duty, and the rumors she'd heard didn't begin to match the reality.
You do not have to state your business here, but if you do, it would be my pleasure to advise you on the easiest way to accomplish your purposes.
Medical technology.
I understand that you have superb research and clinical facilities.
Yes. Can you mention a specialty?
Neurology, specifically the treatment of neurochemically induced cognitive dysfunction.
Yes. According to the current listings, I'd recommend music.
Music?
Harris knew she must have looked and sounded as confused as she felt. The younger woman smiled, but not in mockery.
Sorry, Captain. All the planets of Guerny's fifth star are named for the liberal arts. Music, mathematics, history, and so on. Music is the planet with the largest medical complex devoted to neurology. From here, it's a very short jump and about 2 weeks on in-system drive. We do ask, by the way, that you do not jump except at the designated jump points. We have a lot of traffic. By the time you arrive, Music Station will have a list of contacts for you. Do you wish to append any patient data at this time?
No. No, thank you.
Our pleasure. As soon as my team reports your weapons sealed, you're free to go. Oh, by the way, while I'm sure you wouldn't think of doing any such thing, I should warn you that unsealing your weapons will be a cause for retaliation, even should you manage to frustrate the automatic detonators on the seals, which are designed to blow up a ship of the size that usually carries these weapons. Have a nice day.
Harris worried about getting three identical young men named Smith through the customs inspection at Music Station. She imagined every possible complication.
We're used to this. If we don't wear the same clothes or stand together or go through the same intake booth too close together, no one will notice. All the machines care about is whether our physical features match our formal ID. And of course they do, from blood type to retinal scan to DNA analysis. We can do costuming, but it's not really necessary here.
Harris wondered. She still didn't trust their judgment. She still suspected that one of them actually was the prince, concealed by a shell game with the name tags. But when they showed up at her office without the name tags and in different outfits, she had to admit they no longer looked so identical. One wore a scruffy set of spacer coveralls he must have gotten from a crew member. He slouched against the wall, looking sullen and grubby. Another displayed himself with the peacock air of a young man of fashion, and the third had the earnest, slightly harried look of a businessman late for a conference. Harris continued to worry until she was through customs herself, with her royal letters to the physicians, and found the three Smiths grinning at her from the shuttle waiting lounge. Carly's influence on the treatment team extended into the stable as well. Maris Magerston had been Cecilia's hippotherapist from the beginning, when she had been slung over the horse's back like a stuffed doll. She knew that wasn't a fair description, but that's what it had felt like to her. Although Maris had patiently explained why she was sprawled on a broad pad facing backwards, she still hated it. In her mind, she had composed one furious argument after another, shutting out Maris's description of this and that muscle group doing important things. She didn't want to be this way, an inert load on the horse's back. She felt ridiculous, ugly, flabby, useless, old. She wanted to ride, and that meant sitting up and facing forward. She arrived one day for her session to find an argument going on between Carly and Maris. Brunn, pushing her hover chair, guided it into the tack room out of sight and let her listen.
We start all our clients that way. I've read those articles, thank you. We're not quite as ignorant out here as you seem to think. But it's dangerous to rush clients, and she's over 80.
Are you upset that I've been called in to supervise?
Oh, no. We're not bitter. We're just local therapists on a backwoods planet, also grateful for a chance to learn from the great Dr. Callum Wolfe.
You sound pretty upset to me. Look, I probably would be too. You've been doing a good job for a lot of people all your career here. You do what you've been taught, and people get better. And I come along telling you to change. Is that about it?
Well, actually, I have your training cubes up through 3 years ago. I'd have had your presentations if you'd ever come here before. The thing is, Lady Cecilia's really special on this planet to a lot of people. And we were all trained as strict structuralists, Spinvereans. When you know the electrochemical scan of a nerve, you know what it can do. Period. If I let her get hurt, especially doing something new...
Ah, tough choice. I see your problem. Well, I could be bossy and overrule you. That'd give you an out, but I'd rather not. I do wish you'd let us try.
Oh, why not? At worst, she'll just fall off.
Brunn pushed her back out as if they'd just arrived. Cecilia hoped her expression hadn't betrayed a joy she wasn't supposed to feel yet. This time, they lifted her up into a proper saddle, facing forward. It felt entirely wrong. Her legs were wrong, her back was wrong, her seat was wrong. She couldn't see. She felt a warm hand on either leg. Brunn on the right, and the stable girl Drew on the left. They had been to every session, and Brunn had told her enough about Drew that she felt she knew the groom well.
We're gonna move now, circling to the right.
No.
She didn't move her shoulder. Pride left her that much dignity. The horse moved under her, and she sagged sideways. Brunn's firm hands propped her up. She could feel her legs flopping uselessly against the saddle. Only the hands of her helpers kept her on the horse. But she was sitting up, facing forward. Gradually, the saddle beneath her took on a familiar rhythm. She could feel the horse's stride as its barrel bunched and lengthened, swung slightly from side to side. Maris began to talk, again explaining what the horse was doing to enforce movements Cecilia's body must learn to make. Cecilia decided not to listen. Her back began to feel the horse the way it used to. She had no attention left for someone's words.
Good. You're doing better.
It didn't feel like balancing better. Her spine felt as solid as her luncheon custard. But somewhere between lurches from side to side, she felt for a moment that it was right again. Somewhere in each stride, she was riding.
Think of halting.
Cecilia tried to let herself sink into the saddle the way she would have, and felt herself slump forward as the horse halted. The helper's hands caught her.
Good for you. You halted her yourself. Now, think forward.
Cecilia waited for a moment, recovering what balance she could from the halt, and tried to remember how. She felt her spine lengthen, the pressure in her seat bones, a rising tension between her and the horse.
That's it! The beat! I can...
Whoa! Whoa!
Are you hurt?
Cecilia quickly signaled no. She wasn't hurt at all. She was exultant. She had stopped a horse. She had compelled it forward. Without the use of her arms or legs, blind, unable to speak, she had nonetheless controlled a horse again.
That'll be enough for today.
No!
We'll have to check for damage. I was afraid of this.
She said no. She's not upset by a soft fall like that.
But she's over 80, and she shouldn't have been able to get this horse to trot. I'll have to switch to another.
Carly knelt, grasping Cecilia's hands.
Cecilia! Cecilia, you did it! You stopped her! You got her into a trot! Are you happy about it?
Yes!
Of course she was happy about it. She tried to remember their other signals. Right now, she was too excited to think.
More!
That's what she wanted to say. Was she supposed to jerk her right knee or her left? And then the shoulder jerk for yes.
More? Yes? You want to ride more?
Yes!
Why hadn't she established a signal for damn it, you idiot? Why hadn't she established a signal for reins? She flexed her fingers in Carly's, then pulled slightly.
She wants to hold the reins, don't you, Lady Cecilia? Maris, I think she needs to try again.
All right.
It was going to work. She knew it. This time, Cecilia ignored the need for helpers, ignored the internal voice that told her how ridiculous she must look. The saddle felt familiar this time. The nubbly surface of the reins against her fingers felt better than fine silver or silk. By the end of that session, she had halted the horse three more times and started her into a walk, all with no surprises. She felt as if she had regained herself. Steadily, both her riding and her other therapies made progress. She could grip the special table tools, she did not consider them flatware, and get most solid foods into her mouth. With someone to remind her where they were on the tray, she could choose for herself whether to follow a bite of ham with a bite of toast or eat all the fruit first. She could sit in a regular chair if it had a straight back, and with leg braces on, she could stand supported, leaning against a chest support, to use a keyboard or scrawl with a crayon. She could push the buttons to control her hover chair. She could, at last, use a keyboard. Bit by bit, her voice came back. Though most words defeated her. She began to spell things out, as she did on the keyboard. Now, for the first time since the dark months in the nursing home, she began worrying at the problem of what had really happened. Who had done this? Why? She was dozing one afternoon, after the best ride she had had yet. Maris had taken her out into one of the big fields on a lead line, and they had ridden together in the open. The horse had a lovely, long, flat walk. She had enjoyed the longer stretches of straight movement, the sound of wind in the trees at the edge of the field, and the feel of it on her face. A pleasant lunch, a relaxing nap. In one white light burst, memory returned. She was at Berenice's, dressed for that damned reception. She could feel the ivory silk smooth on her shoulders, the weight of her favorite necklace on her chest. Berenice had worn pale green, and the other ladies were much the same.
A gaggle of old women in appropriate pastels.
It didn't matter if some of them had had rejuvenation. They were still old. She remembered them as children. They remembered her the same way. She hated this kind of thing. Gabble, gabble, nibble and sip, sit listening to a mediocre musical trio and then make a donation to whatever cause. Simpler just to make the donation and go do what you wanted. But she was trying to get Berenice to come around on the subject of Harris Serrano, so she had agreed to be good at the reception. At her elbow, that insipid twit Lorenza. Amazing that a man like Piercy could have a sister like Lorenza. Lorenza, of course, had gone for rejuvenation early and often, but she had always cared more for her complexion than anything else.
I am being nice.
Cecilia smiled at Lorenza. Smooth gold hair, fair skin, looking 30, but those eyes held all of 80 years of malice. It was unnerving, those wicked old eyes in that young face. Exactly why Cecilia hated the thought of rejuve for herself.
Dear Cecilia, I haven't seen you for years.
Well, I run off a lot.
Cecilia felt big and coarse next to Lorenza. She always had. As a child, Lorenza had been picture-perfect, the quiet, well-behaved, clean and tidy girl to whom Cecilia had been compared when in disgrace. Why can't you be more like dear Lorenza? Had come from both her mother and Berenice, every time she'd broken something or come home dirty and disheveled.
I just got back.
Her neck felt hot. She always felt she should say more to Lorenza, but she could never think what.
I understand you took care of dear Ronnie for Berenice.
Yes. He's changed a lot. Fine young man.
Too late, she realized that admitted he hadn't been. If Berenice heard, she'd be furious. Cecilia wished she were any place else, outside by preference, and hoped she wouldn't trip over her own feet. Damn it. She was over 80, rich and famous in her own right. She didn't need to feel like this about Lorenza.
I am being good.
You look hot, dear. Here, have a glass of juice.
She produced a glass, snatched, no doubt, from some passing waiter, and offered it. Cecilia didn't want juice. She wanted out. But she had promised to be good. She tried not to grimace as she sipped the tangy sweet juice. Interesting flavor, spiced with cinnamon and something else, she decided. She turned to thank Lorenza and found to her surprise that the other woman had disappeared. Cecilia was shaking, her heart racing, and someone had hold of her hands. She knew, after a wild moment of panic, where she was and what had happened. Lorenza. Lorenza had poisoned her. And she knew why, or part of why. It made sense now. And she had to tell them, before Lorenza poisoned Ronnie and Berenice and Bunny's family and the Mahonies. And for that matter, Harris and the crew and the prince.
Cecilia, tell us. Try.
E-N-C-A-D-I-D-I-T.
They didn't have to ask her what. They understood that much.
The Crown Minister sister? That Lorenza?
Yes.
Back to the new signal system. It was faster than spelling. Brunn put the keyboard into her hands.
Why?
What if Lorenza had an agent here? Panic shook her. but she had to try it. If she died, she had to save the others.
Prince, maid, stupid, drugs. King, nose, George, demo, Lorenza, Gabe, drug, Ronnie, noticed, told, me.
And you told the king. Ronnie said that. He didn't tell me about George. Oh, but I remember a joke about the term George almost flunked out of school. Was that it?
Bless your wits, yes.
Lorenza did it because you know. Because you told the king. And he must have told the crown minister who told her. And that means she might get the others. Ronnie!
Yes.
His family?
Yes.
More?
Yes, of course, you idiot!
When Cecilia finally could, she would give Carly an earful about what nonverbal people really wanted to say.
Right, let me think. Anyone Ronnie might have talked to, his family, me. Oh, maybe my family as well, and George. Of course, and George's father. Harris Serrano, she knew, but I don't know if anyone else knows that.
Yes,
the king would figure it out. He would have already told the crown minister. And didn't Brun say something about Harris having a mission from the king? That apparent theft of the yacht?
So what do we do?
Go tell Ronnie. Go to Rock House. Warn them.
Me?
Yes, they'll listen to Brune.
Be careful.
I'll leave now. I'll be careful, and I'll make sure no one else gets hurt.
With a quick hug, she was gone.
It's all very well to say I'll leave now, but I can hardly walk to the nearest spaceport carrying my clothes in a sack.
Brun rummaged through her drawers, trying to think of 20 things at once. She needed her papers, her credit cubes, enough clothes.
How long would it take by commercial carriers? What are their schedules? Oh, why didn't I keep the yacht here?
That was easy. It had to go somewhere else and not be obvious about it. She didn't even know where it was.
I'll drive you to the port.
That was Drew, the groom who helped with the hippotherapy. She had ridden out with Drew, times she wasn't with Cecilia. She liked the tough, competent little woman.
I don't even know when things leave.
Here, the closest thing we have to a schedule.
A battered folder listing every ship that intended to arrive at the port for a year at a time, which meant not often.
Are you going to travel in that?
That being the shorts and pullover Brun had put on as usual that morning. With a startled look at herself in the mirror, Brun dove into the shower, then into something that wouldn't instantly trigger suspicions. She hoped. On the bumpy road out, Brun quit trying to read the schedule and instead tried to remember all the things Captain Serrano had told her. Cautions, things to think of, too many. Drew drove the way Cecilia had ridden in the horse trials, flat out, attacking every obstacle, curves, corners, other traffic, with utter concentration.
Are there any traffic laws?
Drew had both legs extended and one arm hanging out of the window of the stable feed truck.
Yes, but not much enforcement. As long as I don't kill anybody, we shouldn't have any problems. The port's on our side of the city.
Brun could just read the fine print of the schedule now. The truck only lurched occasionally. She had lost track of the date and had to ask Drew, who only knew it in local time. They had 13 32-day months, with names like Ock and Beer and Erg. For a moment, Brun's mind drifted to the possible language of the first settlers, then she dragged it back to the important stuff. This was 14 Erg.
Damn! Nothing due for 2 days. I might as well have stayed at the stable.
Except that there's other stuff sometimes. You know, casual, unscheduled stuff. It's faster, I hear. Kareem got to the Warren trials in less than 8 days, while the shortest scheduled passenger time was 12. Of course, it's kind of rough, he said, but I figured you were in a hurry.
Brun nodded. She could always find a room at the port. She didn't remember much about it, actually, landing with Cecilia in the shuttle that one time. It had seemed small and bare, compared to the commercial ports she knew, but busier than the home port on Cerealis. She would just have to figure it out herself. That felt scary, but also exciting. It was more scary and less exciting 3 hours later, after Drew had dropped her off at the shabby little shuttle terminal. The status board there showed nothing up at the station but a bulk hauler headed for Romney, the wrong direction. Her schedule was out of date. The next scheduled passenger ship, also to Romney, wouldn't arrive for 4 days. Unscheduled was, of course, unscheduled. The shuttle, she realized, meant there was only one, was on its way up, and wouldn't be back until the next day. In the meantime, there was nowhere to sleep, because the people who ran the hostel were on vacation. Brunn put her gear in a locker and wandered outside. The shuttle port was also the regional airport. That terminal lay across a half mile or so of paved runways and scrubby grass. She could see aircraft moving over there and wondered if any other terminal would do better. Probably not. There was only one station aloft, and what mattered was its traffic. No wonder they hadn't been found yet.
Hey, you!
Brunn turned to find the shuttleport clerk leaning out the door. He waved, and she strode back in.
You're that friend of Cecilia DeMarcus, aren't you?
Yes.
Where are you going?
She hadn't planned to tell anyone here and buy her ticket on the station.
Oh, back home for a bit. Rock House.
Got money?
Some.
Well, if you're in a hurry, a friend of hers, you know, is a friend of ours. Might be there's a fella could help you.
Tell me.
Private shuttle, over at eBay.
He pointed at a wall, beyond which was, presumably, eBay.
I'll tell him you're coming.
Which assumed she would. But otherwise, she'd just have to sleep on the floor waiting for the regular shuttle. Brunn smiled her thanks, retrieved her duffel from the locker, and walked out again. eBay was neither bay nor hangar, but a large angled parking slot off the shuttle runway. On it was something that looked too small to be a shuttle. It looked, in fact, like one of the training planes Ronnie and George flew in the Royals. Its hatch was propped open, and someone stooped by it, tossing bundles inside. Brunn walked closer, more uncertain the closer she got. The locals tended toward casual dress and behavior, but the young man in scuffed coveralls with shabby boots and a dirty scarf around his neck looked worse than Cecilia's grooms. He glanced up as she came nearer. He had bright black eyes and rumpled black hair.
You're that girl's been over at the ladies. You brought her, right?
Yes.
She better?
Much better.
She sent you?
The eyes had intelligence and some real concern for Cecilia. Brunn wondered why.
Sort of, yes.
I'm going up, then on to Cascar, if that's any use.
Brunn wasn't sure, and she'd left the schedule in the truck. Her helplessness must have showed.
Cascar? 8 days, gets you a bigger port. Should be something going through each way within a few days. Here most everything's going to Romney.
I noticed.
She couldn't help a doubtful look at the shuttle.
She's little, but she's stout. Get us there safely, if you don't mind it being a bit rough.
No. That's fine. How much?
Well, say, 800?
That was ridiculously low.
I hate to say that, but see, I can't afford the fuel myself. Not right now. I know it's for the lady, but...
No, that's fine. I thought it would be more. Look, why not around 1,000?
He wouldn't take more than the 800, and had her insert the cube herself.
That way you know I didn't cheat you. Now, they'll release the fuel.
In the end, she had to help him drag the fuel hoses over and start the pumps. The little ship held an astonishing load of fuel. Brunn wondered if it would get off the ground once it started. Inside, she hardly had room to turn around.
You fly?
A little.
Her Rock House and Cerealis licenses would be no good here. Each world regulated its own pilots, since the differences in atmospheres, gravity, and weather made specific knowledge necessary.
Just sit there, then, and keep an eye out.
The co-pilot's seat, up in the needle nose of the shuttle, gave her a great view of the ground going past as they trundled along the runway. It seemed they had gone a mile or more, and she was wondering if they'd ever get airspeed, when the vibration of the gear died away and they were airborne. With a suddenness she did not expect from the long run, the young man tipped up the nose, did something to the controls, and the craft acted like a real shuttle, shoving her back in her seat for long minutes as the sky darkened from light blue to royal to midnight.
No traffic control?
Nah, not enough traffic.
The shuttle had minimal scans, minimal everything.
Do you really need to stop at the station? I'd just as soon go straight and over, save us a few hours.
Fine.
Brunn looked out the little port to see stars beginning to show as they reached the fringes of atmosphere. She could hardly believe she was riding in something like this, with someone whose name she didn't even know yet, to go into deep space and spend 8 days. She was terrified. She was blissfully happy.
I'm Brunn, by the way.
That seemed to have been right. He turned to grin at her and held out a calloused hand.
I'm Corey, Stephen Grinder's son. The lady helped my dad out a lot when he arrived. Just to let me set up the course here and get the autopilot locked in.